Yes, yes.
So, and my, I like to say that my that what we're doing is tracing the intersection of great ideas, religious ideas, and spiritual ideas.
Can I interrupt you for one second?
Sure.
There's just one technical thing.
Okay.
Can I eliminate so that I don't hear my own voice in the through the headphones? Okay. Can I do that?
I can do that for you.
Okay, thank you. Sorry.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, so the intersection of religious ideas and human experience. We have a good amount of time, and we have a great luxury of having an hour of non-commercial radio.
Yes, that's wonderful.
Yeah, it's wonderful. So we get to have a real in-depth conversation, and we will edit it down. We do get to have a true conversation, and I want to talk about your ideas. And I also am going to come back, in the beginning and as we speak to your experiences, and I want to know a little bit more about you than I can find in in some of the interviews I've read. Although clearly how your life experiences also relate to these great ideas. So
yes,
okay,
that's good. That's technical problem solved.
You all right at that end?
Okay. Yes.
How are we doing, Mike? Are we?
My
headphones are great. No, I'm not hearing an echo. Okay.
I just turned his own voice off into his headphones so he could only hear you, okay?
Okay. Okay. As long as that...
Another quick question. Are you guys going to go past 3 o'clock our time? Like, do you need more than an hour and a half?
No, we'll stick to 90 minutes.
Okay,
that's
great.
Fine, yeah.
No,
Elsie,
thank you.
A little bit of
okay.
A hum on the line.
There's a hum... They're doing big renovations in these buildings, and I can hear, although I'm in the studio,
you
I can hear in the
hum?
Background a drill. Is that what you hear? Okay.
Oh, maybe.
That may be it. That's...
I can do nothing about the drilling. It's a multi-million-dollar construction zone we're listening to. And this is pretty minor compared to some of the stuff we have to put up with.
Boy, I can hear it too. Is that going to come through, do you think? Is that going to be... I know this would be driving Mitch crazy if he's here, but... all right, well, we'll have to let our perfectionism go if there's nothing we can do about the construction site.
No, we actually end up having to put some of this stuff to air. I apologize. I didn't realize it was going to be this loud.
Okay. So you've done what you can at that end, too. Boy, it's really loud, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty quiet, actually.
Maybe when we speak, it may not be so...
How close is he to his mic?
How close are you to your mic? Will that make a difference?
Fairly close. Okay. I don't think it'll make that much.
Right.
Fairly close already.
Okay.
If we get more voice and less background noise, it'll help slightly, but you don't want to get too close or you'll be popping and
singing, she says.
All right. Well, I think we should just do it. Okay.
Yes.
All right. You were born in Germany. And spent your teenage years in Spain with your father. Did you have a religious upbringing at all?
I was brought up as a Catholic, and the first 4 years at school, elementary school, between the ages of 6 and 10, I went to a Catholic elementary school and had first communion, and then continued going to Sunday church for another 2 or 3 years or so, and then I lost interest in religion.
Okay.
There was never any compulsion about religion because my parents were not religious. My father was the black sheep in the family. He was the only person who was not a strict Catholic.
Okay. If you look at your childhood... Do you find, though, whether that was in church or not, kind of seeds of your spiritual insights now that were planted then?
Looking back now, I think I can see some early beginnings. On the whole, I was unhappy as a child. I was unhappy at school. I didn't like the pressure at school. I was unhappy a lot of the time at home because there was a lot of conflict between my parents continuously. And the only relief I could find was getting on my bicycle and cycle, and it was about a 20-minute bike ride, and then I was out of town, out in nature, and I remember very frequently getting on my bike and going into nature, and suddenly I became peaceful inside.
Hmm.
And I remember a strange phrase that used to go through my head when I was out in nature, and that phrase was, "This will always be here." And I didn't know where that phrase came from. And that was a, yes, so that I didn't even try to interpret it. It was just a phrase that came into "this will always," and it gave me great satisfaction to know that this will always be here. And by this, of course, now I know retrospectively, I meant the natural world.
Mm-hmm.
And the other, to me, was the world that I was unhappy in, that was the human, the man-made world, civilization, or whatever you want to call it.
Right, and family life.
Yes.
A particular microcosm of civilization.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's really striking. I mean, you kind of schooled yourself, didn't you? And then you pursued your studies as an adult and graduate studies. It seems that your life was very cerebral. I mean, you were kind of an embodiment of this Western notion that I think, therefore I am.
Yes. Well, the one thing I'm grateful for is that my father was a very unconventional person. And when I dropped out of school in Germany at the age of 13 and said, "I can't do it anymore, I refuse to go to school anymore." And then he had just moved to Spain, and then my mother didn't know what to do with me, so they agreed that I should go and join him in Spain. Right. When I arrived there, he said, "What do you want to do here? Do you want to go to school?" I said, "No, I don't want to go to school." And he said, "Fine, don't go to school, but study something, choose something." So I said, "Okay, I'd like to, first of all, of course, I have to learn Spanish. I'd also like to take up English." So he sent me to evening classes in English. I took classes in Spanish, so I learned Spanish fairly quickly. And then I just started reading the books that I found there at home, some literature, some philosophy. And my life was fairly unstructured for those years. So in that sense, there was no compulsion behind my reading.
Mm-hmm.
I only read what I enjoyed reading. So it wasn't an academic kind of upbringing. And at that time, I was not particularly interested in intellectual things. That started in my early 20s after I had moved to England, where I got a job. And then I became suddenly very interested in intellectual things. I also started to suffer from depression.
Right.
And the intellectual quest was an attempt to find some kind of meaning also for my life, because I believed that the meaning was to be found there somewhere through the intellect.
Okay.
And it took me quite a few years to realize it wasn't there. You couldn't find it that way.
You know, you tell this story in A New Earth about an experience you had, which was actually a few years before you really had kind of a breakthrough and came out of that, where you experienced a woman talking to herself on the train, right? The tube train.
Yes.
Tell that story, kind of caught in her thoughts. And then you came to understand that you were part of this. You had some of the same problems.
Yes. So I would sometimes see her on the train. I caught the tube, the subway in the morning. And she would continuously talk to herself or to an imaginary person, in a very angry voice, or continuously complaining, and then he did this to me, and then he sat in ice, and then how dare he tell me this? So I watched in amazement, thought, how can anybody be so insane and still apparently have a job, because she would catch the subway every morning.
Right.
And one day I was sitting opposite her on the subway, and she got off at the same station that I needed to get off to go to the university library. And I said, okay, she seems to be walking the same direction that I need to go in, so I'll just follow her to see where she goes. And I followed her, and we got closer and closer to the university library, and finally realized, oh my God, she's going to the university. So she entered the library building, and I entered behind her, but by the time I got in, she had already got into one of the elevators, and then suddenly I stopped and thought, how can a person who is so insane be working at the university? That was one thought, because at that time, I still thought the university was the great temple of knowledge and all the answers, the professors and so on, they had all the answers, and I would eventually find them too. Mm-hmm. But at that moment also, after just before going into the library, she had just disappeared in the elevator. I went to the bathroom. I was washing my hands in the bathroom, and I thought, my God, her voice, she never stops talking. And I suddenly realized, well, I do that too, except that I don't do it out aloud. Mm. And then I thought, I hope I don't end up like her. And somebody next to me looked at me, and I suddenly realized in shock that I had actually said these words aloud, just like her. I said, I hope I don't end up like her. So I realized my mind was as incessantly active as hers. Our only difference was that my thought, the patterns of my thinking was mostly based on feeling sorry for myself, and it was kind of depressed kind of thinking. Her patterns were fueled by anger. That was the only difference between us, and that she was articulating those thought movements out aloud, and I was mostly kept them inside. And at that moment, I looked at myself, and there was just a brief moment of an inner detachment from, or another way one could put it, is disidentification from the stream of thinking that what happened inside. I was looking at myself in the bathroom mirror, and perhaps through that external looking at myself, internally what happened, I stepped out of my mind, which is the stream of thinking.
And it broke that cycle momentarily, didn't it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And there was a great relief at that moment, and I laughed. And I realized it's not all that serious. It's only serious if you're stuck in it. Mm-hmm. But that was only a very brief flash of realization. But I always remember it, because it took years before I finally was able to really step out of the stream of thinking and realize there is a place inside me that is far more powerful than the continuous mental noise with which for many, many years I had been completely identified, just like that woman.
Mm. So what happened to you when you were 29 to finally really jolt you out of that?
Well, I was in the depths of depression, and when I was not depressed, I lived in anxiety about my life and my problems and my future. And one night I woke up in the middle of the night, again feeling this sense of dread that I later saw it actually described in one of the novels of Jean-Paul Sartre, a novel called Nausea. And he describes this kind of nausea at existence, and I felt that also, feeling a sense of great dread and fear. The entire universe seemed so alien. That was part of the depression, or part of the fear. Mm-hmm. So I woke up in that state, and a phrase came into my head which said, I can't live with myself any longer. I can't live with myself any longer. And that phrase went around and around in my head a few times, and suddenly I was able to stand back and look at that phrase, I can't live with myself any longer, and I thought, oh, that is strange. I cannot live with myself. Who am I, and who is the self that I cannot live with? Because there must be two of me here, if that phrase is correct.
Yes. Interesting.
There are two of me.
Right.
And so, and that second thought, who am I and who is the self that I cannot live with, that there was no answer to that came to me on a conceptual level, but what happened was it stopped the stream of thinking. And I didn't know why this had happened. It took me several years to understand this process. But at that time, I realized I had stepped out. There was just a stepping out of the stream of thinking, and I was present there as just the awareness behind the thinking. Mm-hmm. And even that I couldn't have said to you, said this to you then.
Right.
I didn't know that then. I was there, and the me that I couldn't live with actually was the continuous mental noise, the stream of thinking that considered life and that considered myself as a problem.
Right, right.
So that was the answer to that question, who am I and who is the self that I cannot live with? The answer came experientially rather than through conceptual thinking. And the answer came experientially by stopping the conceptual thinking. Not that I stopped it as through an act of will. It subsided by itself as the awareness arose. And later I realized the awareness is I, beyond any concept, a deeper sense of presence or beingness that is the essence of identity.
But what do you mean when you say the answer came experientially? How did that unfold experientially?
Well, the experience then, after that night, I woke up in the morning, and the first thing I noticed as I opened my eyes and listened, that everything seemed much more alive than I was used to. The room that I was in, the light coming through the window, objects on the table. And I looked, everything was precious and alive, at almost as if I was looking at it and listening to it for the first time. Mm-hmm. So I was in a state of kind of amazement. Wow, this is all very beautiful. And I picked up a pen, held it, looked out of the window, the beautiful tree that had always been there, but I'd never really seen it. Then I was in London at the time. Then I had to take a bus and go into town. And even there, sitting on top of the double-decker bus, everything seemed so peaceful, even the traffic. Huh. So there was a background of deep peace. Nothing externally changed, but I was looking at everything through this background of a very vibrantly alive peace, without knowing why. Mm-hmm. I only understood why years later. But at that time, all I knew was, I'm suddenly at peace. How is that possible? It was a wonderful experience, although I had no explanation for it. Later, I saw that phrase in the Bible somewhere, the peace that passes all understanding.
Mm-hmm, right,
that's
right.
What happened, because I didn't understand why I was at peace, because externally nothing had changed. Internally everything had changed. And what had changed, I realized later, was that my thought processes had been reduced by about, I would say, almost 80%. So there was a lot of stillness inside, but I didn't even know that was stillness. To me, it was just peace.
Is it also that you sank into your body more, into your... it sounds like you were having a more sensual, sensory experience of everything as well, even just
yes.
sitting still in the same room in which you'd sat
That's
many
right.
times.
So part of that was experience, the sensory experience of the world became much more vibrantly alive,
mm-hmm.
Visual, auditory, touching things. Everything was much more alive because it was no longer being deadened by the conceptual mind, which really for most people and for me up till then acted like a veil or a screen between myself and external reality. So there was the ability suddenly to look at external reality, without the screen of continuous, compulsive, involuntary, conditioned interpretations. Because mm-hmm. that's a normal way of living in this world, is people continuously, through the conditioning of their mind, the mental noise, the compulsive thinking.
The monkey
they
mind,
continuously
is the Buddha saying.
Mm-hmm. Yes, mm-hmm. monkey mind. They continuously interpret what's happening. They put labels onto things. The moment they perceive it, they're already labeling it.
So here's something that's striking to me about your story, because I think many people have had these breakthroughs. I mean, even like the moment you you described a few years earlier, where you had this kind of cathartic experience and you saw something momentarily, and you were momentarily changed. But you had this transformation. I mean, it sounds like, from the story you tell, you were never the same after that day.
Yes.
Why do you think it was that, and you know, maybe this is what we're going to talk about for the next 90 minutes, what you've learned since then, these teachings that you've written about now and bring to many other people, but what was it that, why was it that, what was it that happened to you that was so complete?
I don't have an answer to that. I know that for most people it does not happen in that way. For most people it's a gradual mm-hmm. process. In my case, this deep sense of peace never really left me, although the intensity of it can vary according to situations or whatever. But basically, it's always, since then, it's always been there, either in the background or in the foreground. Why? I don't really know. There was, perhaps because the suffering was so dreadful, the psychological suffering, that it was a dark night of the soul, as it's, I realized later that many people, before this shift in consciousness happens, they go into the depths of depression or despair. And so I went into that depth, and people who go into the depths, the dark night of the soul, very often there is a permanent change that happens when they go that low.
That far. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Most people don't actually have to go into the depths of it, of despair. They have their ordinary daily suffering, and that's also enough to eventually bring about a transformation of consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, but I have no ultimate answer really why this, in my case, it was a very dramatic permanent shift, and for most people it's a gradual transition that I realized that later.
So let's talk about some of your insights, some of your teachings. And you know, here's just something that strikes me, especially as I'm speaking with you, as a contradiction or a paradox, that, you know, what you're describing about this mental shift or the shift in consciousness is that you were very much alive and in the world and present to everything around you in a way you hadn't been before. Yeah. And yet at the heart of your thinking, there's also what one might call an ambivalence about the world. It's not, you wouldn't call it a wholehearted embrace of the world, at least not the way we might say something like that in a normal conversation.
Yes. Yes.
So talk to me about, yeah, how you think about the relationship between consciousness and self and what we call the world. The language probably gets in the way here, doesn't it?
Yes. It's, of course, we all know the Christian expression, being in the world but not of it.
Mm-hmm.
The world, of course, there are two aspects, one could say, to the world. We mentioned it earlier on the one hand, there is the human-made world, and on the other hand, there is the world that is already there, the world of nature, the world of the sky, of the trees, of the flower, of the stars, the sun, the water. There's the two dimensions. When we talk of world, okay, let's say, let's talk for a moment about the man-made world.
Okay.
There's definitely a sense of detachment from all the things that one usually regards as absolutely important in the man-made world, in the so-called my life.
Right. And even a kind of challenge of the idea of what is normally thought of as absolutely real. Right, a definitive.
Yes, yes. This is difficult to talk about, and it really is something that, to take it out of the conceptual realm,
yeah.
It's something that everybody perhaps can experience for themselves at any moment, because the inner equivalent of the world is the stream of thinking, the mind, the human mind. So you carry the world inside you as the conditioned structures of your mind. And to step out of that, that is really what we mean by not being off the world. It really means not being identified with the world in your mind, the stream of thinking.
This is very, very complicated, though, because the world, even the man-made world, is the element of our being and doing. I mean, it is given to us as much as the natural world around us is given to us.
Yes, we kind of inherit it. We inherit the structures of the human mind, and then we are conditioned, of course, by our environment. No matter where you're born, you will be conditioned one way or another. So that's there, and as such, that needs to be accepted. There's nothing you can do about the fact that you have been conditioned and that the human mind works according to certain structures. Now, the important thing is the realization that there is a dimension in every human being that we could call the unconditioned or the timeless. I believe Buddhism sometimes uses that expression, the unconditioned.
Mm-hmm.
It also uses sometimes the word the unborn, the uncreated, the unconditioned. But this is not something to be believed in as an abstract concept, to say, okay, I believe that there is another dimension to life, but that doesn't really free you internally from the world, the conditioned world. That it's something that you need to experience for yourself, the fact that there is a dimension within you that frees you from the conditioned world. It doesn't mean that it dissolves the conditioned world, but you're no longer totally in the grip of the conditioned world. And the whole, if you want to call it this teaching that is expressed through my books and the talks and so on, is all about that, finding that dimension or realizing that dimension within you that is the unconditioned and timeless. So perhaps your next question is, how is it?
One of the things, so this tendency that we, this compulsion that we have, this instinct that we have to think, to analyze, to interpret, as you say, is
yes.
Tied up with our ego. You say, also you make this distinction. I mean, this is perhaps another, a little bit earthier way to be talking about this. You know, you talk about the, as you say, we accept all this and even accept that the mind is an incredible, incredible organ, right?
Yes.
But yet, you know, this is a phrase from your book, our very intelligence is tainted by madness. I mean, that's quite
yes.
a dramatic thought.
Yes. If anybody doubts that, I would always recommend to people to pick up a book on history. Any history book will do, but I particularly recommend 20th century history, the century of rational thought, of science, of great and enormous progress, and read it as if you didn't know anything about it. It's like somebody coming from another planet arriving here and, okay, let's find out about human history. Read the history of the 20th century, and if that is not deeply tainted, if you don't see, I'm not talking to you personally, but generally, if you don't see that the human mind, because whatever humanity externalizes through their behavior, of course, must be based in the human mind. So if we create hell on Earth, as we have done to a large extent in the 20th century, where I said in The Power of Now that 100 million humans had been killed by other human beings in the 20th century alone. But in fact, I later realized the figure is much, much higher. Mm. Some historians believe it's about 150 or 160 million that have been murdered, basically, because war is also murder, by other humans. So what humans have done to each other, they have created hell on a planet that potentially is paradise. They created, for many humans in the 20th century, their life became hell on earth.
Right.
And so, and the same thing you see throughout history, the enormous amount of suffering that humans have inflicted on each other. The greater amount of suffering has not come to humans through natural disasters or diseases. That was a relatively small amount. The far greater amount of human suffering is man-made. And then the same insight that there is a dysfunction or a madness somewhere within that great intelligence. Yes, there is great intelligence there, but it is tainted by madness. I also see that in all the great religions, they start from that realization that there is a fundamental dysfunction in the human mind. Buddha calls it suffering. The normal human condition is one of dukkha, suffering. Mm-hmm. Or in Christianity, it is called sin or original sin. Or in Hinduism, it is called delusion. Delusion.
I appreciate also how when you talk about the Christian, the Christian notion of sin, which you put into that category, that you go back to the original Greek word hamartia, which really means to miss the mark.
Yes.
Yes.
So often when we see a word like sin, some people who are not Christians, they say, "Oh, I don't want to hear that. That's all." But if you look without any preconceptions at the term, especially when you see what the original meaning is, then you see that what it actually points to is a collective dysfunction in the human mind. So all the great religions saw that there was something wrong there somewhere.
And I think the point you're making also is that religious traditions and religious and spiritual teachers in particular, that was their focus, whereas other aspects of human endeavor have had another perhaps focal point, but that this diagnosis of the human condition has been something that religion brought into the world.
Yes, and that has been an enormous step forward, because before humans were so unconscious, well, the majority of humans still are, but some humans suddenly realized they were able to step out of their internal conditioning and see it as if from the outside for the first time. So, for example, I believe the Buddha's realization was just amazing 2,600 years ago. He already saw the human condition so clearly, and he was able to explain that, and that became the Buddhist teaching. But all the founders of the religions, although they probably didn't see themselves as founders of religions, right, but that's what they became, they saw it. But at the same time, they also saw the possibility of going beyond that, of going beyond the madness. So in a way, you could say all the great religions are ways of transcending the inherent madness of the collective human mind.
And yet religions are also part of this story of madness and destruction, and especially as you say, you look at the 20th century, look at the 19th century.
The sad paradox is that those religions that originally were meant to take humans beyond the madness, they, to a large extent, not totally, but to a very large extent, they themselves became part of the madness.
Right. Or again, have become part of that.
Yes, and they were incorporated into the insane structures, whereas originally they were meant to take you out of the insane structures of the human mind. What happened was that more and more people got drawn to these religions and interpreted them through the very structures that are insane. So then, yeah.
When you say something like the structures that are insane, I mean, just imagine somebody is very new to these ideas. I mean, give me some different language for that. A different kind of definition, explanation of it.
Well, rather than that, I'd like to just give an example that everybody can verify in their own experience. A very essential part of this madness in the structure of the human mind is the deep-seated tendency to identify with whatever thought arises in one's mind. And so, for example, when you express an opinion, let's say you're having a conversation with a group of people, you express your opinion or your viewpoint, and somebody else questions it. And suddenly, you are filled with an enormous amount of emotion and defensiveness and anger, and your voice becomes louder and louder as you defend your opinion or your viewpoint. What has happened? You have identified with the mental position of your mind. You have equated a thought with who you are. That's why, I'm not, of course, talking to you personally, but to anybody. Mm-hmm. That's why suddenly you become upset, defensive, and angry when somebody says you are wrong. So why is that? Because your sense of I has become mixed up with a thought. The thought has become I. And this fundamental error is expressed by Descartes. I think, therefore I am. He didn't know it was an error. He thought it was a truth. So he discovered the fundamental error, which is equating the I, which is really consciousness itself, which is formless, not with a thought that arises. And then if you get a bundle of thoughts, for example, a bundle of thoughts about who I am, then that gives you a mental image, a conceptual image of who I am, a me in the head. I call it sometimes me and my story, because it's associated with your past, things that have happened, stories that you retell yourself in your head about things that you did, other people did to you, and you're identified with that. And that creates a false sense of self that arises through identification with the mind. And so you can observe that at any time during the day. You can observe it if you're unhappy with your life. You can look very carefully, what does that mean? You're unhappy with your life. What is your life? Is your life a stream of thoughts in your head? If that's what you think your life is, then yes, and you're identified with that, then yes, you're going to be unhappy, because most stories are not very happy ones. And so if your sense of who you are is derived from a story that you tell and retell yourself and others in your head, which is thoughts, then that is part of the dysfunction. And so the first step to liberation from that is the realization that there is a voice in my head that tells me things that I'm identified with. And when you realize that there are certain thoughts that are repetitive, that tell me something about who I am, tell me something about my so-called life, tell me something about who other people are, either individuals or groups of people, all those judgments about myself and others and situations, I'm identified with that. Can you see that?
Yeah, and how do you understand what that voice is and where it comes from?
All you need to do is see that it's there.
But I'm asking you that. How, what is that voice? Where does it come from in us?
It's the human mind. It's the past in you. You could say I'm not saying get rid of it. Mm-hmm. I'm saying realize that it is there. And if you can realize it is there in the moment of it pronouncing some kind of judgment, as it usually does, about yourself or other people or a situation, maybe an old thought, if you at that moment you can realize, oh, there it goes, there's another thought, but I'm verbalizing it now. But the realization is an awareness with which you suddenly become aware, yes, there's the voice. And that is the shift. And this is not something that you can understand conceptually, because every concept is part of the inner voice. It is only when you realize that you are none of these concepts, and you are none of that, that's the beginning of the new dimension coming into your life that all the ancient teachings already pointed to. So right. Here we have, this can only be really understood experientially, but conceptually it will never be satisfying, what I'm talking about.
Right. Well, right. See? And so I'm thinking, you know, and you're right. And it is very, especially, there are echoes in many traditions, but it's especially, this is the kind of analysis that Buddhism has made. I mean, here are some lines from A New Earth. You write, just again, illustrating what you're saying. The primary cause of unhappiness is never the situation, but your thoughts about it. Be aware of the thoughts you are thinking. Separate them from the situation, which is always neutral, which is always as it is.
Yes.
But, you know, I think one response to that would be sometimes what is happening is really terrible, right? Is objectively
yes.
terrible.
Yes. But it is happening. If it's happening at this moment, then that's what is. You know, you might know it's madness. If you were in a war situation or in a prison camp or whatever, or in many, many other so-called normal situations have a strong element of madness. Mm-hmm. Now, and here again, we come to another little possible opening in the conditioning, which is what I call the importance of the present moment. If you realize the primacy of the present moment rather than always living in thoughts of past and future and through thoughts of past and future, and you find a different relationship with the present moment, which after all is all there ever is, and for most people this is not something they'd ever truly realized, mm-hmm. because most people always live for the next thing. And what is the next thing? It's a thought in your head. The next thing, that the next moment, the future moment, never exists except as a thought in your head. Hmm. Now,
actually happens will also always be different, right? Then
yes.
It will always be itself, and we don't know what that is yet.
Yes. So, essentially, future does not exist. And essentially, past does not exist, because you cannot experience past or future. This is not something that, I don't want to make a philosophical statement and say there is no past or future. I'm only saying in your first-hand experience of life, all you ever experience is the present moment. And even when you remember the past, you need the now to remember it. You can only remember mm-hmm. it now. Mm-hmm. When you think about the future, the next moment, that is going to be much better than this one. That's always the assumption. Mm-hmm. When people value the next moment more than they value what is, they're dissatisfied with what is, but they're hoping some other future moment is going to free them from this dissatisfaction. But the other moment, because it's only a thought in the head, never actually comes. Because when the so-called future comes, it appears again as the unsatisfying present.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so that here is another realization that can take you out of identification with conceptual thinking, with the stream of compulsive and involuntary thinking. And that is realizing the primary importance in your life of the present moment. And so when you realize that, you begin to have a different attitude towards the present moment. Whereas most people regard the present moment as an obstacle because they have a thought in your head that at some future point it's going to get better. I'm going to find fulfillment and satisfaction when this, that, or the other happens. There's always something. When you realize, okay, where is my life? Essentially, it's here and now, and it will never not be here and now.
And
suddenly, you pay more attention to this.
And how does that change the experience when, in fact, what is happening is very painful, even destructive? I mean, it's worst case scenario, because every moment is not painful and destructive. But how can that truly be liberating, even in those moments?
A large amount of the pain, although I'm not talking about physical pain, but most of the human pain is psychological pain. And if you see that whatever is the case in this moment already is as it is, and when you see that, you come, even if it's unpleasant or so-called bad in one whatever way, it is. And if you internally argue with what is, then you are not in inner alignment with life.
Right.
You want to be somewhere else. And actually, if you can accept what is, then a different energy arises within you through that acceptance. You have stepped out of the conceptual mind structures through entering the present moment. So present moment is the way out of thousands and thousands of years of conditioning. It's out of being identified with continuous thinking. So the present moment is where freedom lies.
Which has had to do with survival also, isn't it, for those thousands and thousands of years, or some of them anyway?
Yes, there has been this incredible instrument has come into being, which is the human mind, thinking. It's an unbelievable instrument, but to some extent we've been taken over by the thing that potentially is a great tool, but we have become servants of this tool. We are no longer masters of this tool. It possesses us. We don't possess it. Hmm. And I believe that's where something has gone wrong. And this is why so many people, because historically we're reaching a very critical point on this planet, and so many people are realizing that something fundamental needs to change. And the fundamental dimension is not outside, it's within each human being. And so there is a great readiness now on the part of many, many people for this inner shift in consciousness. And that's why so many people read these books. I was amazed when The Power of Now came out 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
When I wrote the book, I thought, okay, if this will appeal to a few people who have already gone deeply into meditation or whatever, that's what I thought. And then I suddenly realized many people who have never read a spiritual book in their lives, they looked at it and said, wow, I understand now. I understand my life. I understand the structure of my unhappiness.
Right.
I understand that it is not necessary.
Right. And you've now had, 26 million people watch the 10-week
yes.
webinar with Oprah Winfrey and millions of copies of A New Earth, and not just your book. I mean, there's an explosion.
Yes.
And you speak about, and I think we can all see many, many indications of that, this spiritual energy, and you are actually saying you were writing about a profound shift in planetary consciousness that is destined to take place in the human species. Now, you know, one thing that, and I mean, I'm part of this too, right? I have this public radio
yes.
program about religion and spirituality. But here's something that I hear many people saying these days, these last years, you know, something is changing. There's a shift in consciousness. We're understanding more. We're learning more. And yet, I worry that this is a Western, that this is a luxurious phenomenon, that this kind of shift in consciousness is only available to those of us who don't have to think about survival, right? You know, because there are many places in the world right now, and this is also part of what's happening on our planet now. I mean, suddenly some of the basic elements of survival, food, are scarce. And
yes.
Yeah, so how do you think about that, that disjunction?
Well, as long as survival occupies your mind, then there's very little room for anything else, and even for unhappiness. The strange thing is, as long as you're struggling to survive, you don't even have the energy. The mind doesn't have enough energy
to have what we call unhappiness.
An unhappy me, an unhappy self. Mm. You wouldn't even know what somebody is talking about when they talk about unhappiness, because you're struggling to survive. Mm-hmm. But once there is sufficient, then a different thing comes in. The mind suddenly begins to work in a different way and becomes very problematic. So the fact that now there are still many humans who don't have enough food and so on, there's a great imbalance on the planet, again, largely created by the human mind, by the greed of the human mind. And even in many third world countries, a lot of the suffering in many third world countries is to do with internal conflict. And so, yes, that is there. But the essence is the transformation of consciousness has to start somewhere on the planet. And then it will affect the rest of the planet. So it's not something that we can't say, okay, we need to create perfect conditions on this planet and then we can go into spirituality, in the same way that you cannot say for your own life, I need to sort out my own life first, and when I get rid of all these problems that I have or think I have, when I've sorted out my personal life, then I'll be able to really investigate the dimension of the spiritual dimension. And that doesn't work, because the very reason why there is why in your life, and the collective and the individual are really very much the same. Mm-hmm. So by in your own life, if the spiritual dimension does not enter, there is no end to your problems. So it doesn't work if you say, okay, I need to have a good income and a really peaceful place where I can meditate every day and enjoy nice body treatments, and I can really tune in and be at peace and go very deep. Mm. It's not going to work.
Right.
You're not going to get that. So the spirituality has come into the so-called unsatisfying reality. This is the moment to enter it, rather than waiting for your life to improve. It will never really improve. Unless the spiritual dimension comes in.
Let me ask you this. I think a criticism some people have, or awareness of what's been called New Age spirituality. And I think we're in a different era now, even that what might have been called New Age is evolving into something different. Your work is sometimes associated with that sphere. And I think that there's a concern that it is engaged in a spiritual quest, and yet it's very individualistic. That it is inward looking, and in that way would diverge from some of the impulses, in the great traditions, in the major, some of the world traditions like Christianity, Judaism. This impulse that comes from, also from that consciousness, or from faith to repair the world, a kind of active compassion, the agape love of the New Testament.
Yes, yes.
Yes. Is there a disconnect? Is what you're doing? Yeah. How do you react to that idea?
No, I believe that really, it's for every individual to realize within themselves that there is the old consciousness working in them, the structures of their own mind, and there is the possibility of stepping out of that, the shift in consciousness. It's for you to experience, not even 100%, but to experience that shift from being identified with the thinking to being the awareness behind the thinking. Once you are, you realize that in essence you are not whatever is in your mind, but the awareness behind your mind, then a much greater depth is suddenly active in you. And when you touch that, when you have access to that, but this is, we're still using dualistic language because essentially it is who you are. Mm-hmm. When you are that, then the way in which you interact with other human beings and with the world at large changes. You become a force for good in this world. It's only there where really true compassion and true love, which ultimately is not what the ego thinks love is, which says, don't you ever leave me, don't you dare leave me, I need you, or whatever, mm-hmm. some kind of... It's not that, but true compassion, true love, and real, the joy of being alive, they all arise on that level. And it's only then anybody who embodies this shift in consciousness, and many people are going through it now on the planet, not the majority yet, it's still a minority, but they are, they cannot not have an influence on the world around them. They influence, not by wanting to influence, it just happens. So, and then many people will be called upon to do things in this world, to be active, but it comes from a much more peaceful place within, not from an angry, conflict-ridden state of consciousness.
Okay.
And that there's great, very great power comes through you then. And then it's only those that have gone through the shift or are going through the shift can make a true difference in this world. But the primary thing is not changing the outer world. The primary is going through that change within. And then you cannot not change the outer once that has happened.
Hmm. I think wasn't it Gandhi who said... I can't change the world. Yeah, that would. He also said, "I can't change the world. I can change myself."
Yes.
It's very
and ultimately, you see, that's once you see that you are the world, then you see that's where true change happens. Mm. So it's not. It sometimes looked at it from an external viewpoint as if you were preoccupied with yourself, but no, the normal state of consciousness, there you are continuously preoccupied with yourself.
Right. I mean, I think what you're saying also, and certainly those experiences could be confused. I mean, someone might imagine that they were very spiritual and yet still very preoccupied with themselves. But I mean, I think what I hear you saying is that for you, a sign and a symptom of a true shift in consciousness would be that one was having a good effect on, a different effect on the world around.
Yes, a very good yardstick or criterion is, for example, your relationship with other human beings. Do they become more peaceful? Do they become free of conflict? Are you still contributing to the conflict, or does conflict dissolve in your presence? So that always gives you a very good reflection of your inner state. What are your relationships with, especially the people closest to you, the people at work, and so on? That gives you a good reflection of where you are at in your state of consciousness. Yes, you're right. It is easy, even here, it's easy, of course, for the ego to come in through the back door, as it sometimes happens with people who are drawn to the spiritual dimension, who may even have initial spiritual experiences. And then the ego comes back in a subtle way and creates a new mental image of who I am, where I see myself as a very spiritually evolved, highly evolved person, more evolved than most people, of course. Mm-hmm. And you,
and that's why and religious so, leaders can, are also imperfect yes, human beings and can be yes, damaging human beings.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So the ego can come back in that way. If you ever, in a subtle way, that can happen that you begin to feel superior to others who you think are not spiritual. And of course, there's the ego again, in another disguise.
You know, you have a really interesting analysis of, or just an observation about humility and real humility that can arise when people are completely, are doing something good in the world and completely at home in that and have a true passion for their calling. And that in some of those cases, I mean, humility is one of these words really hard to talk about. It's hard to talk about in American culture. But it's, to me, it's very hopeful because you also named the fact that, that true humility is out there. And I think when you say that, we all know we've known people like that.
Yes. And basically, one could say true humility is no longer living through a concept of mental concept of who you are.
But just being that, right?
Just
fully
being that. Mm-hmm. Yes, mm-hmm. yes. Mm-hmm. And so it's not something one can actually cultivate, because anything that you cultivate really is a mental concept.
Right.
So if you say, okay, I'm going to try to cultivate real humility.
And it's also really not a sacrifice in that sense, right? Because
no.
I think in a Western culture, humility is like debasing yourself. And that's
yes.
not what you're talking about. It's really about being fully alive.
Being fully alive and fully engaging, being in with life in the present moment, mm-hmm. which is where life happens, mm-hmm. fully responding to the needs of this moment, but not rejecting this moment, not arguing with this moment, but being open to it, which is being open to life. Mm-hmm. So you are there as a conscious presence rather than as a mind-made entity that wants something from somebody or needs something from somebody or from your situation. And that's a wonderful shift to be there as simply as the presence for this moment.
And is it? I wonder if it's also some aspect of that is that when you are fully alive and fully present, even if in a very powerful way, right? I mean, even if that your presence is powerful, there's something about knowing your place in the scheme of things. I mean, being aware of how complex and large everything around you is.
Yes, and the vastness of it all, and then you don't impose all these concepts on reality anymore. You can still use mental concepts when they are needed, but this the compulsion to continuously interpret whatever you are experiencing at any given moment, that is no longer there, and there's great freedom in not compulsively interpreting other people, situations, and so on, ultimately the present moment always. Not imposing all these judgments, that's another word for it, which are really all, it's all thinking, imposing thinking, right. thinking continuously on the world, which is so alive and so fresh and new at every moment. It's all, when we impose the continuous compulsive thinking on it, then we deaden it. Mm. We become dead to the aliveness of the world. We become dead to the aliveness in others. Mm. And so we can no longer have empathy for others when we are behind a screen of conceptualization through which we judge others. Mm-hmm. And it's a dreadful condition to be in, but it's become the normal human condition. Mm. And so, yes, the mind is beautiful. The ability to think is a great thing. But be free of it when there are many occasions when thinking actually diminishes your aliveness. Mm. And it does not mean you fall below thinking when you are open to the present moment.
Or that you turn your mind off, right?
It doesn't mean you become semi-conscious or it just doesn't mean that it's a thing that happens to you when you have a few drinks.
Right.
Some people, when they take a few drinks, just to be free of their mind for a little while, so they for a little while they feel a little happier. They have it, and then they okay, let's have another drink. I might feel even more happy, and of course it doesn't work because eventually you become unconscious. So drink, for example, or many drugs do that. They take you below thinking. To some extent, they free you from the compulsive thinking also, but it's not the way for humanity to go, to go back to below thinking. Right. What we are talking about here is a state of alert attention to what is, where compulsive thinking no longer operates. This means you rise above thinking to a large extent in your life. You're alert, present. The whole thing of Zen is really about that. Zen is a very practical way of taking you beyond compulsive thinking, where you can face life without the interference of the mind, still being able to use the mind when it's needed, but not being used by it. And that is the great freedom, and that's the possibility.
Yeah. Zen is very much a practical discipline, I mean, a commitment.
Yes.
And so what is available to someone who's not a practitioner of Zen? I mean, just start there. Because what you're talking about is so simple, and it's the hardest thing to transcend our thoughts.
Yes, that's because it makes life so simple, and yet the simplest thing, because of our conditioning, the simplest thing looks like the hardest thing.
Right.
But so it's for everybody really to experience that, sometimes in just very small ways in their daily life. I call them little signposts. These are just little pointers, as for example, a little phrase like, ask yourself throughout the day, what kind of a relationship am I having with the present moment? And then that takes your attention into your inner space, into your emotional field, and into your mind. Mm. Is my mind denying the present moment? Is there a contraction in my emotional field? Am I in a state of stress? What is stress? Stress means... Stress is normal in our civilization, but really basically what it means is you would rather be somewhere else. Stress means you want to be in the next moment, or you want to already to be finished with what you're doing while you're still doing it. You'd rather be finished with it. Or while you're traveling towards some place, you'd rather already be there.
Okay.
But you're not. And stress is so normal that everybody accepts that, okay, if you're successful in life, then you must be under stress.
Right. But I think counterintuitively, I think you're saying you lean in rather than wishing it away.
Yes, it's by becoming friendly with the present moment. What's my relationship? Is the present moment my friend or my enemy? Another little pointer. And that's it's a strange question, but if you look very closely, you'd find that very often, because of the conditioning of one's mind, you make the present moment into virtually an enemy.
Or
it becomes an obstacle. For some people, they go through their whole lives regarding the present moment as an obstacle.
And you're saying that we do have the power, however, whatever's enclosed in that moment, we have the power not to define it as an obstacle, and that's going to change the way we approach it?
Yes. The first thing is the realization of what you're doing. In other words, one could say, see the madness in yourself. And that's not a bad thing. It's a great thing, because when you see the madness in yourself, that in you which sees the madness or is aware of the madness is not part of it. So seeing that there's something in you that is dysfunctional, that creates continuous unhappiness, that creates continuous stress, if you see that at work in yourself, through your mind, that is not something to be depressed about. But that means you are awakening. Hmm. And that which is awakening is the awareness behind the thinking, the consciousness behind.
I want to talk about your notion of the pain body. And, you know, one way you describe it is the energy field of old but still very much alive emotion that lives in almost every human being. Where did you draw this idea from? Was it something you became aware of in yourself?
I became aware of it when for quite a few years I would see people for counseling sessions every day. And through my work with those people and through then looking at my own life and the many years of unhappiness in my own life, retrospectively, I understood the structure of unhappiness in my own life by understanding the structure of unhappiness in other people that I was sitting with. They were people who were telling me their sad stories all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And gradually, and people who had enormous amount of emotional pain, carried enormous amounts of emotional pain inside them that I observed. And I said, how can there be so much emotional pain when the situation that they're in is cannot actually justify that much emotional pain?
Right.
And so I realized that there's something in everybody that is past, remnants of past painful emotion. And these remnants of past painful emotion from pain that you suffered as a child, perhaps even pain that was passed on from previous generations. I don't want to necessarily talk about genetic, for example, pain that's passed on genetically and so on. So everybody carries that, some to a greater or lesser degree, emotional pain from the past.
You know, something that's a way that's come up in my conversations, especially with a remarkable yoga teacher who became paraplegic in a car accident when he was 13. And he talked about one of the things, and he learned through yoga that he could be whole again and healed, even if that didn't mean that his legs, that he can walk, right?
Yes,
but
yes.
One of the things he had to reckon with was what he calls body memory. And I think that's very similar to what you're saying, which is that he had and still has no conscious memory of the events of the accident, which crippled him. But
yes.
His body was there and had stored that memory, and that was something that came out through the practice of yoga. And then I have also then after that spoke with a woman who does acupuncture and massage therapy and had been working with women who'd been sexually abused. Mm-hmm. And it was a similar story she told, that there was body memory, that what you would say the pain
yes.
body, and that had to be released, as well as whatever psychological work or thinking work. But, you know, in some ways... So this is in some ways harder than what you're describing about how we can gain control of our thoughts, because this is below the conscious level. I mean, this is not even something we know. We don't know where it is, and we can't even necessarily name it with words or get rid of it with words. So what do we do?
You are right. It is sometimes harder, depending on the intensity of your pain body. It may be harder to identify that than to identify your thinking, to become mm-hmm. aware of your thought movement. But the basic principle is the same, and the basic principle behind it is the you being the awareness rather than being identified with what is happening, either in the mind or in your emotional field.
So you're saying that when you... Okay, I'll keep going.
Yeah. One way of looking at the emotional pain body, and it's actually quite close to reality, although I'm not saying this is an absolute truth. It is a way of looking at it, and that is to regard it almost as an entity, an energy form.
This pain in your body, or this pain body,
old emotional pain as mm-hmm. the pain body, the accumulation mm-hmm. of old emotional pain.
Mm-hmm.
So I call it the pain body, and because the way it appears in in people, especially periodically, it appears almost as an independent entity, an energy form that lives in people. That I have observed many times
and
when
I was
working with people.
And that then complicates whatever is actually happening in the present
moment. It complicates what is happening, yes, and it colors what is happening. Mm-hmm. It colors what's happening with the old emotion. Right. So when the pain body, basically I've observed that for most people, the pain body has a dormant stage when you hardly know that it's there or you might not feel it at all. It's dormant. And then it has an active stage when this pain body very much comes to the surface in your life, in a relationship, or even not in a relationship. It might just become into your mind. Mm. So there are the two stages, the dormant stage when you don't even know it's there, possibly, and periodically the pain body awakens from its dormant stage. That's the cycle that I observed in many people. And it does that because it needs to feed on more emotional pain. Mm-hmm. And when I first realized that, I was quite amazed when I looked at it in people. What that means is when the pain body awakens from its dormant stage, it suddenly looks for more emotional pain because it can only feed on that kind of energy that corresponds to its own energy field.
So how
do you pain.
How do you banish that or heal it?
Yes, that's first. Of course, you need to know when it arises in you. Ah, there's the pain body. That already is the beginning of the being free of it, to recognizing it for what it is rather than completely identifying with the pain that arises.
And do you recognize that because if you become aware that you have a degree and an intensity of emotion that is simply not proportionate to?
Yes. Very often it's out of proportion to the so-called triggering event. Mm-hmm. But you need to be there as the awareness in the moment that it arises. Before I carry on about this, let's just talk about two other aspects. Mm-hmm. The pain body has basically two ways of feeding on further emotional pain. One is through your thinking, and one is through other people's reactions. So if you are sitting alone in a room and the pain body awakens from its dormant stage because it needs to feed a harm experience of pain, what happened is the old emotion, perhaps triggered by one thought in your head about your sad story from the past, the old emotion rises up into the mind, and suddenly your entire thinking becomes extremely negative. It reflects mm-hmm. the emotional energy. So all your thoughts that you're thinking about your life and your life situation and your past and other people is deeply, deeply negative, totally distorted, of course. It's distorted by the pain of the past. So, and then what you are telling yourself in your head, if you identify it with all your thoughts, is this the very painful story. And this is the pain body is then feeding on your thoughts, on your thinking, because every thought is an energy formation.
Right.
So the emotional energy is then feeding on your negative thinking. It loves it. If at that moment somebody came into the room and said, "Why don't you stop your negative thinking? It's making you unhappy," you wouldn't want to stop if you had already become identified with it.
Right.
You would find a reason not to stop.
It's kind of an animal energy then, doesn't it?
Yes, it's an addictive thing. Once you've mm-hmm. become taken over by the pain body, you become addicted to pain, emotional pain. Mm-hmm. So it feeds on the one hand on your thinking. On the other hand, if there are people around you at the time when the pain body awakens, and that's the favorite thing, the favorite way of feeding for the pain body, mm-hmm. is to provoke a negative reaction, for example, in your partner. Hmm. It could be a little situation, something he or she says or does, and you push the buttons in your partner, and you amplify something that otherwise would be a relatively insignificant thing, perhaps, and suddenly you know the pain body has a certain cunning intelligence to it. It knows exactly what buttons to push in your partner or the person close to you or your family member. And it'll say those things that are most likely to provoke an intense negative reaction. And then it'll feed on the drama. So that's the second way then in which the pain body feeds is the drama in relationships. And many couples recognize this truth. They say, oh, yeah, that's true. Every week or every 2 weeks or every 3 weeks, we go through our drama as if...
You're very aware of this. I mean, you've even called yourself, you had something of a life of a hermit for many years, but you've been in a relationship for 10 years. I mean, do you have this drama in your relationship?
No, I don't have drama anymore.
You don't?
No.
Because why? Because how have you tamed that in yourself?
The way to become free of the pain body and it's is to be there as the aware presence when it arises in you, so that it can't possess you anymore. Because when you identify it, you are possessed by it when it arises. So if there's if the awareness in you is strong enough, then the pain body cannot take you over. It doesn't take over your thinking or control your behavior in your relationships. If there's still remnants of old pain in you, I still occasionally find an emotion arises, and I immediately know there's the emotion. I feel it. So in other words, I become the space for the emotion. I'm not the emotion. I'm the space for the emotion. And I'm not even saying to the emotion, go away, I don't want you. It says, there it is. It's again coming into a friendly relationship with the present moment, because at this moment, whatever emotion you experience, and this is the way to eventually become free of the pain body, is not to say, I don't want to have a pain body or anything like that, just to say, to see that it's there. So it's the same, the awareness that frees you from compulsive thinking is the same awareness that eventually frees you from the pain body. So the key, both to becoming free of unconscious and compulsive thinking and becoming free of identification with the pain body, is to be the awareness. And another word for that, and this is where I sometimes use different pointers to help people get in touch with that, another pointer rather than to say awareness is to say, can you be the space for whatever is arising at this moment, which might be an emotion? Can you be the space for that? Can you?
Is that when you talk about inner spaciousness? Is this?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So you become, by accepting this moment internally or externally, you become the space for whatever is arising at this moment, internally or externally. Rather than reacting against the form of this moment, you become the space that's behind the form.
Okay.
So, and another word for space, of course, is to say formlessness. You are the formless, and you're not the form. So you're not the emotion, because that's the form that arises, the emotional form. But when you say yes to the emotion but recognize it, allow it to be, because it already is, it's now, it's here now. So by becoming friendly with that, even an unpleasant emotion, fear, let's say, there it is. Can I allow this to be there? You better, because it is there.
Right.
And then you become deeper, or you realize that you are deeper than the emotion. And that frees you from being controlled by the emotion. And then gradually the pain body weakens because it can't feed anymore on your relationship or on your thinking. Now, if you have a lot of emotional pain from the past, you may always experience from time to time some painful emotion arising.
It is part of you. It is
Yes, whatever. And it's not a problem because you are the space for that. So another little pointer, I always like these little pointers that can be very helpful, is to ask yourself, whatever is happening in your life, externally or internally, to ask yourself, can I be the space for this? And then you have to say, okay, it is, it already is. Why argue with the isness of life? Because it is. And then if action is required, you will act. You're more likely to do the right thing when the foundation for your action is becoming one with what is internally. Then if that is the foundation for your action, whatever you do in response is going to be empowered by the intelligence of life itself, because you're open to life, which is now. Otherwise, you will not respond, you will react out of your old conditioning. It is never quite right because it's old. So that's the, can I be the space for this? A very helpful little pointer in one's life, whether it's an emotion, whether it's the pain body, whether it's a stream of thinking that goes through your mind, that restless thinking, and realize that's what it is. Restless thinking, mental noise, and you're the space for that. And gradually you become more rooted in the spaciousness that's within you than identified with the forms of your life, the external forms of your life, or the inner forms of your life, emotions and so on. And that's the freedom. And then you can balance your life between the two. There's the world, and there's the that which is deeper than that which is timeless. And essentially, the timeless dimension of consciousness itself, the space, the formlessness, what Buddhists call the emptiness.
Right.
But the emptiness is also the fullness of life, but not the manifested life. It's the formless one life. Well, this is the essence. Yes.
And I think, you know, where... So I think some might say that this way of being is tilting, you know, giving so much into the emptiness that perhaps you're not connected with the fullness, the earthiness, the messiness of life. I mean, you said a minute ago you don't have drama in your relationship. And I think some people might say, well, if there's no drama, there's no excitement. Now, I have to say, I do experience you as having great energy. I mean, I know sometimes you speak about enthusiasm as opposed to passion. I think somebody might read your vision and say, are we talking about a world where passion disappears?
No, I have great enthusiasm or passion, whatever word you want to use, for this teaching, if you want to call it
right,
that.
Right.
So it doesn't mean that the intensity of life does not disappear. It actually becomes enhanced. You experience life more intensely, but not in a mad way, not in the egoic intensity that needs some kind of stimulus to be on a high, which never lasts, but an intensity that comes from a deeper place. For example, I go for a walk with my dog every day, and I experience in a little forest, and I experience nature very intensely every day. It's so wonderful and so alive. Everything is so alive. And so to be there, is every day it's fresh and new. So this very great intensity. And I remember when I was depressed in my 20s, I had completely lost contact with nature. As a child, I had it, and then I lost it because my mind was far too active. There was nothing in nature that has anything to do with the problems that my problems that I thought were so important.
Right.
And so there is great intensity that comes in. It doesn't mean we lose a balance, because our civilization as a whole has completely lost the balance, because it's totally identified with the external forms.
And
it's,
you know,
totally identified
you,
with that.
You write a lot in your book about the pressures of fame, and you are now a rich and famous person. You know, and that's also part of our obsession with external appearances and forms. And, you know, has this experience pressed on your spiritual insights? Has it presented challenges?
Well, yes. I believe in this life, no matter what situation you encounter, every situation will have its own challenges. Mm. So it's never the case that once this or that happens to me, I'll be totally fine. Internally, you're fine already. That's the main thing. But no situation is going to provide complete fulfillment, because there will always be another side to it. I don't enjoy particularly being well known or being recognized in the street or being recognized in restaurants, people looking to see what I'm eating. And particularly since I love actually being invisible, so to speak. I love not to be noticed, to be in the background. I've always loved that. And now life has given me the opposite as a challenge. So what I do is I don't react, and I simply say, that's how it is. This is the downside of the great things that are happening. This is what is. I have to surrender to that. And I do. I wear a baseball cap and sometimes dark glasses.
Right.
And sometimes, nevertheless, people stop me in the street. And this, although I try to avoid that, the strange thing is the moment it happens, I'm completely there and I welcome it. It's actually wonderful to hear from somebody, oh, thank you so much. Mm. They thank me personally. I don't feel that I personally have done anything. It's just consciousness has moved through this form, that's all. Mm. And so it's satisfying to say, my life is so much, you've changed my life. They say, I know I haven't changed their life, but I understand what they mean.
Okay.
And that's very nice. The downside is that people are looking at me and saying, why are you drinking coffee? You shouldn't be drinking coffee.
You're too pure.
Yes.
We need to finish. I think I want to ask you a final question. And in all the interviews I've read that other people have done of you, I haven't seen you ask this, and I'm not sure you really directly address it in your work. You speak of God sometimes, but I mean, do you believe in God, or do you believe that there is a sense and purpose behind the universe as a whole?
Definitely, yes, yes. I use the word God rarely because it's been misused so much by the human mind. It has made the timeless, eternal, that which cannot be named, the vast mystery of life itself has. When you say God, you make it into a mental idol. It becomes a thought form, and then you think you know what you're talking about. But of course, that's the misuse of the word God. But what ultimately it points to is the essence of who you are and the essence of what everything else is, the underlying essence of all life. Words are so useless when we talk about this. That's why the beginning of the Tao Te Ching, the ancient Chinese book of wisdom, the first line in the Tao. The Tao, of course, means the great mystery, the great unmanifested power that is behind all life, which cannot be expressed in words. And so the first line in the Tao Te Ching is, the Tao that can be spoken of is not the true Tao. So at the beginning of the book says you can't speak of it, and then it continues to speak of it.
And that's what we've done this hour.
Exactly,
as well.
Yes. The ultimate thing is the realization of the formless essence of who you are, because if God has any reality in this world, it cannot be separate from who you are in your essence. And finding that in yourself, really, I see as the purpose of human life. and then the external world, the temporary world, the world of forms also changes as a result of that. But the essence is finding who you are beyond form, beyond time.
Well, thank you so much. I've thoroughly enjoyed this, and I could have kept going. I'd love to talk to you about sometime again if we ever meet, is
yes.
I spent many years in Germany. And, you know, you also talk in the book about the pain body is sometimes a collective phenomenon, that we also carry
yes.
the pain of our civilizations. And, I have to say, you write a lot about China in your book. But
yes.
that's, I have to say that that's something, not that I had this language for it, but, you know, there is this collective pain in Germany.
Oh, yes. I mentioned that in the book,
oh,
too.
Oh, do you?
Germany.
Yes.
Yeah. Some countries have more
that.
Heavier collective
yes.
pain body, and Germany is one of them. And also some Eastern European countries have a very heavy
right.
collective pain body.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's very it's real and
yes.
not something that... It's hard enough to be conscious of these things as individuals, and certainly that much more complicated to be collectively aware. Hmm?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
good.
Thank you so much. Thank you for giving
thank
me all
you.
This time.
Yeah. Thank you. I enjoyed it. Yeah. So perhaps we'll do it again
yes.
sometime.
Yes, I hope we'll talk again sometime. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank
Bye-bye.
You very much.
Yeah.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.